reported structure fire for Light 464.
We're taking some pretty heavy flak on Adams about Hobart. There's three
now. We got
fire.
Balls through the window.
As I speak, 2,000 California National Guardsmen, 750 California Highway Patrol officers are being deployed to Los Angeles County Sheriff's, Los Angeles Police Department units to assist in their efforts to arrest violators and to restore order.
But tell me, what exactly, how do you feel about all of this?
I feel that it's a great travesty of justice. I feel that the jury in Simi Valley gave the okay to continue to abuse and oppress and suppress black people in this country. I feel that there is...
Early today, I directed 3,000 members of the 7th Infantry and 1,500 Marines to stand by at El Toro Air Station, California. I have committed these troops to help restore order.
There are fires burning, there are people being beaten, there is looting. It is a dangerous night in the city of Los Angeles.
I just want to say, you know, can we all get along? Can we get along?
On April 5th, 1965, Rodney King was born in Sacramento, California, before spending most of his childhood in Altadena. During his time at John Muir High School in Pasadena, it would never have occurred to him that his life would take him on a path leading to destruction and civil unrest, reigniting the conversation about race relations in the United States in April and May of 1992. 26 years after his entry into the world, early in the morning of Sunday, March 3rd, 1991, King, with his friends Bryant Allen and Freddie Helms, was driving west on the Foothill Freeway in the San Fernando Valley. The three had spent the night watching basketball and drinking at a friend's house. At 12:30 a.m., officers of the California Highway Patrol noticed King's car speeding on the freeway. The officers gave pursuit at speeds which reached 117 miles per hour, while King refused to pull over. King would later say he fled the police hoping to avoid a driving under the influence charge and the parole violation that could follow. After approximately 8 miles of pursuit, which included several police cars and a police helicopter, officers cornered King and his friends in his car. The first five Los Angeles Police Department officers to arrive were Stacy Kuhn, Lawrence Powell, Timothy Wind, Theodore Briseño, and Rolando Solano. All three passengers in the car were roughly treated as they exited the vehicle, but a combination of fear and bad judgment led King to attempt to flee. This move was taken as an act of aggression by the arresting officers, who subsequently rained down a total of 33 baton strikes and 7 kicks to King's body, limbs, and head. Such occurrences were not uncommon in the LA area, and minority community leaders in Los Angeles had reportedly complained about harassment and use of excessive force against their residents by LAPD officers. Darrell Gates, chief of the LAPD from 1978 to 1992, has been blamed for much of the institutional abuse of people of color and, according to one study, scandalous racist violence marked the LAPD under Gates' tempestuous leadership. Under Gates, the department had begun Operation Hammer in April 1987, which was a large-scale militarized push to crack down on gang violence in Los Angeles. The Christopher Commission later concluded that a significant number of LAPD officers repetitively used excessive force against the public and persistently ignored the written guidelines of the department regarding force. The biases related to race, gender, and sexual orientation were found to have regularly contributed to the LAPD's use of excessive force. The commission's report called for the replacement of both Chief Darrell Gates and the Civilian Police Commission. Set against this backdrop of tension and unrest, the beating of Rodney King may ordinarily have passed without much further incident. However, plumbing salesman and amateur videographer George Holliday captured the beating on his camcorder from his apartment near the intersection of Foothill Boulevard and Osborne Street. 2 days later, Holliday called LAPD headquarters at Parker Center to let the police department know that he had a videotape of the incident. He could not, however, find anyone interested in seeing the video. Holliday eventually went to KTLA television with his recording. As his video camera was in another part of his residence, Holliday was unable to retrieve it until the officers were already in the act of beating King. The footage as a whole became an instant media sensation. The Los Angeles County District Attorney subsequently charged 4 police officers, including one sergeant, with assault and use of excessive force. Due to the extensive media coverage of the arrest, the trial received a change of venue from Los Angeles County to Simi Valley in neighboring Ventura County. The trial jury had no entirely African-American members and was instead composed of 9 white Americans, 3 women and 6 men, 1 biracial man, 1 Latin American woman, and 1 Asian American woman. On April 29, 1992, the 7th day of jury deliberations, the jury acquitted all 4 officers of assault and acquitted 3 of the 4 of using excessive force. This sparked outrage in the African-American community, and the riots began the next day, peaking in intensity over the next 2 days. A dusk-to-dawn curfew and deployment by the California National Guard, U.S. troops, and federal law enforcement personnel eventually controlled the situation, but not before 63 deaths, 2,383 injuries, 12,111 arrests, and an estimated $1 billion worth of damage threatened to rip the City of Angels apart. During the riots on May 1, 1992, Rodney King made an impassioned television appearance pleading for an end to the riots.
I just want to say, you know, can we all get along? Can we get along? Can we stop making it horrible for the older people and the kids? And we've got to quit. We've got to quit. You know, after all, I mean, I can understand the first upset for the first 2 hours after the verdict. But to keep going on like this, and to see the security guard shot on the ground, it's just not right. It's just not right, because those people will never go home to their families again. And I mean, please, we can get along here. We all can get along. We just gotta. You know, I mean, we're all stuck here for a while. Let's try to work it out. Let's try to beat it, you know. Let's try and work it out.
On Father's Day, June 17th, 2012, King's partner, Cynthia Kelly, found King dead underwater at the bottom of his swimming pool. Rodney King died 28 years to the day after his father, Ronald King, who was found dead in his bathtub in 1984. On August 23rd, 2012, King's autopsy results were released, stating he died of accidental drowning. The combination of alcohol, cocaine, and PCP found in his system were contributing factors, as was a focal myocardial fibrosis. Conclusion of the report stated the effects of the drugs and alcohol, combined with the subject's heart condition, probably precipitated a cardiac arrhythmia, and the subject, incapacitated in the water, was unable to help himself. Since King's death, his daughter Laura has worked with the LAPD to build bridges between the police and the black community. She also started a non-profit, the Rodney King Foundation, on behalf of her father. In March and April of 1992, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were wrapping up the European final leg of their Into the Great Wide Open tour. This leg saw them play dates in Germany, the UK, Ireland, Belgium, Switzerland, France, Norway, and on April 3rd, they close out the tour in Malmö, Sweden, playing an extended set of 28 songs to 6,000 Swedish fans, closing out with Learning to Fly, Making Some Noise, and then the serene lullaby, All Right For Now. Tom couldn't have anticipated that on his return to Los Angeles, everything was very soon going to be very far from all right. Tom Petty. Tom Petty. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, my fine friends. Welcome to the first episode of season 9.5 of the Tom Petty Project podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Brown. This is the weekly podcast that digs into the entire Tom Petty catalogue, song by song, album by album, and includes conversations with musicians, fans, and people connected with Tom along the way. Today's episode covers Tom's response to the LA riots, the non-album single, Peace in LA. In conversations with Tom Petty, Tom tells author Paul Zolo, "I came back from Europe, and the day I got back, the LA riots started. We had been on tour in Europe, and when we got back, and all that broke loose. And I just had the feeling that the word peace needs to be on the radio. We just need to hear peace, peace. I quickly got on the phone, arranged the session, and went into my little room and wrote the song really fast." Now, I'd asked on Tom Petty Nation on the Facebook group if anyone knows what date the song was first played on the radio, but I wasn't able to find anyone who could give me an actual date. According to Tom, though, it was on air within 28 hours of the recording being completed. Musically, this will be a fairly short episode because this song is more about the message than it is an attempt to craft an inventive, you know, narrative or whimsical idea. This is all about mood and feeling. The song itself starts with an ominous synth pad and a wailing guitar bend from Mike Campbell. We do know that Howie Epstein wasn't in LA during the recording of this track, and I'm guessing that Stan Lynch wasn't either, due to the use of a drum machine on the song. Stan had moved back to Florida permanently shortly after the release of Full Moon Fever, so my guess is that it's just Mike, Tom, and Ben Montench playing on this song. The drum pattern repeats without change throughout the entire song, and along with the kick and snare, it has a single tom hit before the first and third beat of every bar. The main instrumentation in this track indeed is the greasy, low-slung Rhodes piano and the little bit of organ that Ben Mont is playing as the call interspersed with those howling guitar responses from Mike. The bass, and I'm going to guess this is Tom playing, is keeping a really steady groove going underneath the piece, and after 30 seconds of intro, Tom hits us immediately with the title line. As he commented to Paul Zolo, "We just need to hear peace, peace," and the song starts with the "We need peace in LA" line. It's a direct, unambiguous message. The first verse carries through on a straight E minor chord with some very light touches on guitar and keyboard, which builds slightly as the verse progresses. Tom lays out a very clear position in this verse too, essentially agreeing with the consensus view that the acquittal of Rodney King's assailants was the wrong decision. The line, "If the powers that be let evil go free, you must understand, don't play into their hand." Again, not an overly ambiguous line. The verse transitions into the chorus with a little fret noise from Mike Campbell before we have that drop to C major, up to D major, and then back to E minor, which comprises the first movement away from that repetitive drone note. The second verse here is a much more hard-edged rock guitar fill from Mike Campbell and a very warm synth swell that mirrors the introduction to the song. Listen carefully to it at the 1:53 mark for a very cool little tremolo arm volume swell guitar note from Mike. And there are a lot of little parts of this song, and I'll suggest an idea about how this one was recorded nearer the end of the episode, but think about Mojo. After the line, "There's hurt and frustration," we get a very slight difference as Mike starts to play a broken suspended E minor fifth chord or something around that type. I think what he's actually playing there is a D major chord over the top of that E note that the bass guitar is playing. So you get that sort of pedal point situation. And Tom points out the futility of looting and needless destruction in the lines, "Don't need beating and shouting, don't need burning and looting," and "How can we help if we steal from ourselves?" Now, some of these rhymes are a little clunky and feel slightly forced, but with Tom wanting to get a positive message out quickly, I think the earnestness and directness of the lyrics actually work in the song's favour. At the end of the second verse, Tom again references they. "We need peace in LA, whatever they say." This is aimed squarely at the legal system that allowed Rodney King's attackers to walk free, and despite, as we've commented on before, Tom's lack of overt political positions in most of his songs, this one rings through as a hill he's prepared to stand on and openly and unflinchingly defend. The bridge drops to D major with some wonderful arpeggiated guitars and Ben Mont layering up that synth pad along with the piano. Tom tells us to stay cool and don't be a fool in hushed tones before Mike Campbell moves into a rapid-fire single-note style solo that is actually mixed quite low in the overall mix. The last verse is a simple two-line idea. "At the end of our road, justice goes up in smoke. But if we all play the game, we'll end up a joke." This again sees Tom seeming to side with the non-Caucasian position that action, not acquiescence, is necessary at this point. This leads into the chorus being repeated to the outro. We have more rhythmic piano and those guitar fills from Mike before Tom says, "And all over the world, whatever they say, we need peace in LA." The song fades out with what sounds like Tom singing some very strangled vocalizations of the lead line. Now, it could be Mike Campbell playing through a talk box and heavily processing his tone, but I'm more inclined to think that it's Tom howling in the background to take the tone into a darker, more desperate final scene in this macabre one-act play. All right, folks, it's been a bit of a heavy episode so far, but it's time for some petty trivia. Your last question was this. Along with the two new tracks, Mary Jane's Last Dance and Something in the Air, which other song from the Greatest Hits album was re-released as a single, inexplicably failing to chart on the Billboard or US rock chart? Was it A, Breakdown, B, American Girl, C, Listen to Her Heart, or D, don't do me like that? Astonishingly, perhaps, the answer is B, American Girl. 17 years after it was first released as a non-charting single, the song did hit number 9 on the US Billboard Bubbling Under Hot 100 and number 68 on the US Cashbox Top 100. And I had to look at both of those charts because, I'll be honest, I had no idea what either of them was. I'm also not 100% sure because there are conflicting sequences listed on Wikipedia, but it looks like this was the third and final single released from the Greatest Hits album. If anyone knows what date it was released, I'd love to know that, so please get in touch. Your question for this week is this. Which Elvis song did Tom claim that he and the Heartbreakers did better than Elvis? Is it A, Baby Let's Play House? B, All Shook Up? C, Treat Me Nice? Or D, Wooden Heart? As I said at the top, this song isn't hugely complex or inventive in terms of structure or movement or arrangement. My guess is that it was recorded in one or two takes, with Benmont on keyboards, Mike on guitar, and Tom on bass playing along to that drum loop. They would have then overdubbed Tom's vocals, mixed it, and fired it out the door as quickly as possible. And I think that this approach is probably the best because had Tom laboured over the premise or tried to flesh out a more nuanced lyric, the impact and the honesty of what he was trying to say probably would have been lost. The song would also not have landed at the time that Tom was hoping to inject a little peace into the airwaves. The insistent drum loop and the simple direct bass line provide the menacing undercurrent that would have been pervasive throughout the riots in LA, while the stabbing guitar fills provide the element of danger and unrest. But for me, the whole thing works because of the outstanding contributions of Benmont Tench. From the moody synth pads and those fabulous Rhodes piano licks, we get a masterclass in playing subtly and perfectly that really makes this song come alive, when it could have plodded along at a fairly pedestrian pace. Hand on heart, I'm not always a fan of overtly political songs, or certainly songs that are specific to one event or moment in history. Now, there are very strong exceptions to this rule, like Peter Gabriel's Biko, which shares a similar sort of stripped-back aesthetic to Peace in LA, but takes it even a step further in its starkness. The Hurricane by Bob Dylan, which chronicles the false imprisonment of Reuben Carter, or Killing in the Name by Rage Against the Machine, which rails far more furiously against police brutality and the beating of Rodney King. But there's something about pop and rock stars being political in a song that can work if it's done well. And there's more than one occasion when it doesn't. Another one of my loves is the band Queen, whose drummer Roger Taylor, in his solo career, once wrote a song called Nazis, decrying fascism, but with a cringe-worthy lyric that undercuts the message the songwriter is trying to convey. Then there are songs like Fortunate Son, Born in the USA, and The Revolution Starts Now, which are much more song and melody oriented and intended for wide consumption beyond, or in addition to their original message. All this to say that protest songs by affluent rock stars can be a tricky business. And coming into this episode, I wasn't sure what my feelings were going to be. I don't listen to Peace in LA, really. It's not a song that fits anywhere in Tom's catalogue, I don't think. And it belongs to 1992 and the events that unfolded in April and May of that year in Los Angeles. Okay, Pettyheads, that's it for this week. Musically, like I said, Peace in LA it's interesting in the way that I've sort of posited it was recorded and the speed with which it was written and released. Lyrically, it's direct, frank, and in my opinion, unapologetically on the side of the downtrodden. Am I going to listen to it regularly from now on? I don't think so. Do I think it's a poor song? Absolutely not. It sits as one of those curios in an artist's catalogue that can only be evaluated in its own context. To that end, I'm going to judge this one not against the rest of the catalogue or against the rest of, the entirety of music, but based on whether I think Tom executed the idea that he had. In conversations with Tom Petty, he tells Paul Zolo, "We gave all the money to different good causes in East LA. To this day, I still get letters of thanks from missions in East LA because money keeps coming in. It ended up on the playback box set, so they still keep getting the royalties. So it was something I feel good about because it did some good. And as I was going down the road, I saw somebody had graffitied the wall and it said, Peace in LA, and I thought, damn, That's something. We had an idea, got it on the air, and now it's painted on the wall. So I felt really good about it. The sentiment is solid. The song is different enough from the Heartbreakers catalogue, and it had some financial impact in helping people in Los Angeles. So with all that in mind, I'm going to give Peace in LA a solid, 6 out of 10. Okay, so before I let you go, I did feel it was important to include some background for the origins of this song in the episode, but really only summarize the events that led to the LA riots, leaving out a great deal of important background. If you want to know more about the build-up and aftermath of the traumatic events of 1992, I've left a link to an excellent National Geographic documentary in the episode notes. Produced by Oscar winner Simon Chin and Emmy winner Jonathan Chin, and directed by Oscar winners Dan Lindsay and TJ Martin, the film brings a fresh perspective to a pivotal moment in US history and adds perspective to what we are seeing in the world today. The US currently has a population of around 335 million people. Of those, around 12% or 40 million are Black or African American. Approximately 1.8 million people are currently incarcerated in the US, higher than any other nation in the world, including China, which has four times the population, and it has more than double that of Brazil, that is in third place in that list. 32% of those incarcerated are Black, 23% are Hispanic, and 10% are multiracial. This means that around 570,000 Black Americans are currently incarcerated, compared to around 558,000 white Americans, despite the disparity in their percentage of the population. Black and African Americans are 2.5 times more likely to be arrested than the national per capita average, and Philando Castile, Freddie Gray, Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd have all in recent years shown that much work is still needed to address issues of systemic racism and bias toward people of color within the US justice system and political power structures, which behave statistically unfavorably toward people of color. Tom Petty once sang that it'll all work out eventually, and I do hope that's the case in terms of race relations in the United States. Of course, a whole truckload of progress has been made since Rosa Parks refused to leave her Montgomery bus seat almost 70 years ago, and I truly believe that we can all get along. We simply need the moral fortitude and commitment to electing leaders who will prioritize equality and empathy as foundational principles of their office. The Tom Petty Project is a proud member of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. Go check us out on Twitter at Deep Dive Podnet. I'm sure you'll find something there that you like. You can also check out my other podcast, Seaside Pod Review, a Queen podcast that I do with Mr. Randy Woods. And I also co-host the Ultimate Catalog Clash with the hardest working man in podcasting, Corey Morissette. You know what? We just wrapped up season 2 of that. We're done Metallica and we're moving on to a new band that you'll find out about in about 4 weeks. Don't forget to follow me on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube at The Tom Petty Project, and on Twitter at Tom Petty Project. Go follow, like, subscribe, do all those things, and leave a comment or a rating somewhere. Keep talking to me on social media, and I do enjoy reading out your comments on the show, and as a weekly reminder, The Tom Petty Project is not affiliated with the Tom Petty Estate in any way. When you're looking for Tom's music, please visit official streaming platforms or go to your local independent record seller to grab some actual physical media. That includes, you know, go online and when it's ready, go buy Matt Jaffe's album, go buy Jake Thistle's album, go buy the Nexor's album, go buy Jeff Slate's new album when that comes out. If you buy directly from the artist or you buy from Bandcamp or you buy from their websites, all that money goes to the artist rather than most of it going to Spotify and Apple Music and those kinds of places. Don't forget to check out Tom Petty Nation and Tom Petty Fans Forever groups on Facebook if you're not already a member of those. They're cool hangs and well worth spending a little bit of time in. Until we meet again next week, keep listening to and sharing Tom's music. Try to be kind. Try to say I love you to someone at least once a day. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll be back with you next week to talk about, arguably, the best new song that's ever appeared on a greatest hits album, Mary Jane's Last Dance. Bye-bye.